New York Times reporter Christopher Wren worked overseas for 17 years. He was the bureau chief in Cairo, Moscow, Beijing, Ottawa, and Johannesburg. In each of those places, he lived with his wife and two children and their cat, Henrietta. Wren writes about his feline's adventures in The Cat Who Covered the World. Now, I should point out that Henrietta did not originally figure into his travel plans.
I was not going to take that cat overseas. And I suggested to the children that maybe, you know, the cat would be much happier living in Central Park, and all of her relatives lived in New York, and this didn't wash. The children said no, they would not move unless the cat went, because to them the cat was hearth and home. And my wife sided with the children, so the cat went overseas. I thought it was a great mistake to take her overseas, and I was very, very wrong.
You know, a couple of things occur to me. One is that I wouldn't have thought it would be so easy to take a cat along with you to other countries. I mean, we hear about in England, for instance, they're not allowing pets in, but that's not true, I gather, in other places.
Well, it is true in England, which made it difficult. She spent one night in the Heathrow Airport, or two nights in the Heathrow Airport, and was outraged at having to be put into quarantine while we went off to do things in London. But other countries were far more accommodating. Countries like France and Italy, where she visited, also had airlines that were happy to take cats. And Moscow, we had a bit of trouble, not really a bit of trouble. We brought her in on a New Year's Eve because the Times was running a big piece by Solzhenitsyn, or about Solzhenitsyn, that we thought would upset the Russians, so we thought we'd have trouble. So I went in quietly on New Year's Eve, traveling with nothing but 22 pieces of luggage
and two
lively children, a beautiful wife, and a cat. And I thought, I said to my wife that this cat is going to prevent us from getting in. It's going to create such fuss. They took her out of the cage and looked at her, and the veterinarian said, "Какая красивая американская кошка! What a beautiful American cat!" And then everybody rushed over to look at the cat. The customs officials, the border guards, they took turn petting her. And then somebody said, "Кошку устала, the little cat's tired." And then the children are tired, and they rushed us through customs.
So Henrietta actually got you into Moscow.
She got us into Moscow in about a quarter of the time it usually would take. And that happened in other places, when you went to Rome or other places, and they saw the cat. Everybody was very accommodating.
You know, it brings us to the other element of this. A moment ago, you described the cat as hearth and home for
kids. Mm-hmm.
Traveling children, traveling with a family, frankly, for a correspondent, has to create some difficulties. And I suppose you need to find ways in which to bring home with you for your expatriate children.
Yeah, I think that was true. I think that was one of the great advantages of having the cat, that they would go to a place and they would identify with the cat, have somebody to play with. And if the cat was there, this was home.
How old were the kids when you left?
When we left, they were at the prime listening age of 3.5 and 7. And I think that it just helped because the cat just opened a lot of doors. I knew a European diplomat, who later became an ambassador and knew as much about what was happening inside the Kremlin as anybody I'd met who was not Russian. And he couldn't be seen talking to the press. So he would come over into our apartment, and we'd have tea or drink or something, and he would put Henrietta on his lap, and then he would brief Henrietta on the latest nuances of the policy shifts in the Kremlin while I took notes from a corner. And he couldn't be accused of talking to the press because he wasn't. I mean, I was eavesdropping, but he was talking to the cat.
Anybody asked him, he could honestly say he hadn't told you a thing.
He would say, "Talking to the press? Moi?" That was Henrietta did help with news gathering.
One of your postings was in Cairo, which
that's right,
in the Middle East, and Henrietta went there as well. Now, you know, all of us have seen those famous portraits of the black cats in Egyptian hieroglyphs and so forth.
Oh yes.
Is Egypt cat friendly?
Yes, Egypt. It's a good observation. Egypt was the country where cats were first domesticated. They came in from the desert. It was what I call the primal contract between man and cat, that they agreed to go after the mice that were threatening the granaries in return for being given a place by the hearth and such food as they needed. But in ancient pharaonic Egypt, one goes back and digs into that history, anyone who killed a cat at one point, even by accident, faced the death penalty or a heavy fine.
Do you want to just say that again? Anyone who killed a cat faced the death penalty?
Yeah, in pharaonic Egypt, because they were considered so valuable. The export of cats was prohibited by the pharaohs for a while because they felt this was a secret weapon for protecting your grain, so they wouldn't do that. And Herodotus or somebody else went over there, and no, it was a Roman visitor who said that he saw a case where somebody had accidentally killed a cat running over with a cart or something, and the mob came and tried to lynch him. And Herodotus talked about that if a cat died a natural death, then the householders where the cat lived were expected to shave their eyebrows as a sign of mourning. So there's this great tradition of...
Well, this must have been something of a comfort for you when you waltzed into Egypt carrying Henrietta.
Well, we had a problem. The cat got separated from us. We moved into new quarters, and she went out to explore and came back, and the doorman, or I mean the boab, as they call him, whoever it was, didn't think she belonged there and shooed her away as a stray. And we lost track of her, and she disappeared, and we were paying people in the neighborhood of Zamalek to look for her.
And, of course, this was a new posting for you, so she had no connection.
She had no sense of,
house.
Where we were living. None at all. It was pretty much definite in our minds that she was dead, and we finally explained this. We thought she'd either been run over or killed by one of the feral dogs. And then 5 weeks later, I was working in Israel. I had just come out of Syria and was via Athens, was working in Israel, and I called Jacqueline, and she said, Henrietta's back. I said, she can't be. It's impossible. She said, well, she came back. She was bringing the children home from school one evening, and they heard this meow, and one of them said, that sounds like Henrietta. And Jacqueline said, no, it isn't. And then they looked around, and Henrietta was under a palm tree some distance away, and then come out of the shadows. She was skin and bones. She was had been in some bad fights. She was pretty battered. And I think she probably had gone up against Nile rats because they're really vicious. And she'd had to survive in the garbage dumps of Cairo, such as they are, for 5 weeks.
Even though she may not have known where you were, some part of her actually did.
It was some sense of her that helped her to home in on it, but it took her a long while to do it. So it was a remarkable story.
You know, this is also a particularly important time in the history of the world that you were there. And we've been talking about Henrietta and laughing about her. But you were, in fact, there when Anwar Sadat declared that he would go to Jerusalem.
That's right.
If
he was going to go to Jerusalem, and I, like everybody else, didn't believe it. And he went to Jerusalem. And, in fact, that incident with Henrietta, where I called Jacqueline, was because I was in Jerusalem covering Sadat's visit to the Knesset.
Is it a shock for you? I mean, you were there in Egypt when Sadat appeared to be making the gesture that would bring peace to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
You look back, that's 20-some years ago now.
Indeed it is, yeah. I had when I went to Cairo, I had an older reporter friend who was really quite a marvelous person named Don Skanky for the Los Angeles Times. And he said, the secret of covering the Middle East is to decide that the ultimate solution is impossible, and then you work on it bit by bit. A little over a year ago, I thought we would see an agreement because both sides were exhausted. Now, of course, it's flared up again.
Yeah.
And one goes back to that theory, how do you break through this? They made so much progress, I think, on the Camp David talks that they had between Netanyahu and Arafat that I think a lot of the work was done, and I'm afraid we're rapidly losing all of that.
Do you think
gain.
It's been thrown away, or do you think that the work that they did is still sitting there for someone to pick up on?
It is still sitting there for someone to pick up with, but I think the feelings have gotten so brittle on both sides there that it's going to be hard to close that gap. And an American president with a real gift of diplomacy and a real a streak of luck and a streak of genius could put it back together again. But I don't know that that's going to happen in the near future.
Christopher Wren worked for the New York Times for 28 years. He writes about Henrietta in The Cat Who Covered the World.